Obviously, the study of Haggai, or the story of Haggai, begins further back than the book which bears his name. We need to go back, really, to the time of the downfall of the monarchy of Israel, to the time when the Babylonian armies had come into Palestine, had besieged Jerusalem, taken the city, the king, the princes, had removed most of the portable valuables to Babylon, and till by the year 586 the temple was thoroughly ruined and laid waste. That's the position at the end of the second book of Kings. Not at the end of the second book of Chronicles. There's an interesting difference between those two books that you might well note. That Chronicles and Kings, of course, are not two twin records, not two records of the same things, but they are two records with, in each case, a very different emphasis. Kings being particularly concerned with the secular or political aspects of Israel's livings, and Chronicles stressing very much the ecclesiastical or at times the spiritual aspects, and has a lot to say about the temple. That's why when you come to the end of the book of Chronicles, there's a difference that isn't noted in the second book of Kings. And second Chronicles finishes with the accession of the new king Cyrus of Persia, and of how he was moved by God to make it easier for the people of Israel to go back to Palestine and there to build the temple. Thus saith Cyrus, king of Persia, the Lord God of heaven hath given me all the kingdoms of the earth. Who is there among you of his people? His God be with him, and let him go up to Jerusalem. The book of Ezra, which belongs to the same period, of course, as both Haggai and Zechariah, tells how that edict of Cyrus was carried out, how the people went down to Palestine, how on their arrival they built a temporary altar and began by offering sacrifices to God. By 536, they had reached the stage of laying the foundation of the temple, or perhaps in view of later events, it seems more likely that they'd had a ceremony of laying the foundation stone, because they ran into difficulties which soon stopped their work. Odd kind of difficulties, because they were difficulties which arose out of a desire on the part of the Samaritans to help. The Samaritan says, look, let's join hands in this, let's help you in the building of your temple. And Israel said no. The Samaritans, of course, were a kind of half-caste race. Esarhaddon, the ruler who had followed Sennacherib, had put a number of settlers into north Judah, and probably they'd intermarried with some of the Jews who had escaped the persecution and the captivity, and produced this race of half-Jews. So the true Jews wouldn't associate with them or allow their help in the building. And what had been desire to help soon became a desire to hinder, a hatred, and the work ceased. For about 16 years, nothing happened at all, until we come to our prophecy of Haggai. And then, in 520 BC, we have the beginning of the opening of the book. In the second year of Darius the king, in the sixth month, in the first day of the month, came the word of the Lord by Haggai the prophet unto Zerubbabel the son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and to Joshua the son of Josedek the high priest, saying, Thus speaketh the word of the Lord of hosts. This people say, the time is not come, the time that the Lord's house should be built. Then came the word of the Lord by Haggai the prophet. There are two very remarkable aspects about this little prophecy, which I particularly want you to see, and were my reason for this little leaflet. First of all, notice number 2 on page 2, the calendar, because we have a prophecy with a remarkable exactness of dating. Very, very precisely, the day and the month and the year in the reign of King Darius is noted for all the messages that are given. Counting the first 6 verses of Zechariah, as we will in a moment, we have 5 messages altogether, dated. We have also 2 notes about the progress of the work. One you'll notice at B, 2B, on the 24th of the 6th month of the 2nd year of Darius, 24th of September, they came and did work. You'll find that the 14th verse and the 15th verse of Haggai 1. The Lord stirred up the spirit of Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and the spirit of Joshua, the son of Josedek, the high priest, and the spirit of all the remnant of the people, and they came and did work in the house of the Lord. Where did is a verb, so that we would say they came and made a start. That's the idea, right? They came and did some work. The other note about the progress is in the 2nd chapter and the 18th verse. And again, dated, you'll notice, on the 21st of December 520. Consider now, from this day and upward, from the 24th day of the 9th month, even from the day that the foundation of the Lord's temple was laid, consider it. Which gives some point to my earlier remark that perhaps the first stone-laying ceremony in 536 was nothing more than a ceremony, or if it was, then little preceded but that foundation. Because now they are making a fresh start and have laid the foundation. Truly. It is also perhaps a comment upon the desolation and the waste that had taken place, that 3 months have elapsed from the beginning of them going there and beginning to work until the stage when the foundation can now be well and truly laid and building commence. The second point I've tried to highlight by this little calendar on the left, on the right-hand side of the page, that you might see what struck me very forcibly when I began to read this book, of how remarkably short is the compass in time of the whole prophecy. That so far as the Bible is concerned, at least, the life work of Haggai appears to be compressed into but 4 months. I've no doubt at all that Haggai said a lot more things than are written here, and did more. But in the divine purpose, it seems that he was prepared and brought to this particular moment, held just for this brief time. You notice on the calendar, we begin on the first day of September with the first message, and the whole is encompassed by the 24th day of the 4th month, December. You might, if you like, with profit, consider how long Haggai had waited for his opportunity. You might consider and reflect deeply upon how much his soul might have chafed when he had gone about and seen the desolation that was there, and realized that the Lord's house was so neglected whilst all the people were looking after themselves. And how he must have longed to stir up his country. And so many and many a time, in the inscrutable ways of God, does he keep a man just for one moment of glory, when it may be one moment of glory may be a sequel to the rest of a lifetime of waiting. So our Lord himself was 30 years preparing for that brief shining in Israel which brought showers of blessing on a world of sin. Or as you might like to hear it in the terms of the psalmist, a day in thy courts is better than a thousand. Well, in spite of such a short shining, Haggai was nonetheless a true guiding light. He was a prophet in the real sense of the word. Not a foreteller, not a soothsayer, not a fortune teller, but one who related the conditions of his time to the word of God. One who could speak truly God's word because of the conditions and in the light of those conditions. And he speaks surely as one commissioned. Notice particularly Haggai chapter 1 verse 13. Then spake Haggai the Lord's messenger in the Lord's message unto the people, which is literally by the Lord's commission. There's no doubt at all about the authority which Haggai has for his words. And in that authority he speaks both rebuke and encouragement. And his rebuke is most scathing. In a modern expression, he certainly pulls no punches. The people were saying, this isn't the right time to build the temple. You see how we're beset. Economic difficulties. The cost of living's gone up. All that we earn, it's like putting it in a bag with holes, or as we would say nowadays, your money just goes down the drain. There's difficulties all around us, politically too, and this isn't really the time for building. And Haggai looks at them scornfully and just brushes all their feeble excuses on one side. And he says, what are you talking about? This isn't the time to build the Lord's house. It's the time for you to build your own houses, apparently. Because as I go around, I can see that you've made yourselves fairly comfortable. And some of you with a bit more money have even been able to panel your houses. That's the meaning of that word, sealed houses. It doesn't mean they've done something fancy to their ceilings. The word is really paneled. They've been able to make very elaborate decorations within their houses, and they'd been very industrious and very lavish in furnishing their own houses. Verse 4, Haggai 1. Is it time for you, O ye, to dwell in your sealed houses, and this house lie waste? Now therefore, thus saith the Lord of hosts, consider your ways. Ye have sown much and bring in little. Ye eat, but ye have not enough. Ye drink, but ye are not filled with drink. He clothe you, but there is none warm, and he that earneth wages to put into a bag with holes. Thus saith the Lord, consider your ways. Go ye up to the mountain, and bring wood, and build the house, and I will take pleasure in it, and I will be glorified, saith the Lord. He looked for much, and lo, it came to little. When he brought it home, I did blow upon it. Why, saith the Lord of hosts, because of mine house that is waste, and ye run every man to his own house. Notice that. They were eager. Ye run. They were eager to do their own houses. But they haven't time to do the Lord's work. All their difficulties hadn't stopped them from doing their own. They'd had their bad seasons. Their cattle, their crops had failed. But these things they were to look at, not as reasons for... These were the results of their neglect, and their continual neglect, and that therefore they should regard their conditions as a summons to awakened service. And Haggai's work had such an effect, words had such an effect, that the governor and the high priest led the people and began to build the temple. And in 5 years, the work was finished. And it was then 516. For those of you who like figures, you might like to reflect that that was exactly 70 years after the second going into captivity, exactly as the prophet had said in Jeremiah, they should go into captivity for 70 years. If you want to debate the point, of course, there may be two periods mentioned, from the first captivity to the first return, the second captivity to the finishing of the temple, but both periods are still 70 years. So precisely are the works of God brought to fruition. Now, that's an interesting story, historically and I suppose biographically, but within that framework of history, there's a very modern word. For we also have been called to a kingdom and to a temple, and we've made beginnings, and many a time I think our beginnings have dwindled away to nothing. We've begun a life joyous and vigorous. We've begun with faith and goodness in service, and by have become indifferent. Some of us older ones must sadly reflect on that and admit that there have been many such times when our zeal has died and cooled off. Now, perhaps welfarers in general, being so much younger, will not need to admit such times as that. And yet, indeed, you may look back to a day, perhaps not so far off, when your vigour was stronger and your keenness brighter, sharper. The day when, above all else, you desired to build in your heart a sanctuary, a temple, where the Lord of life might adequately live. Maybe the last time you came to Swanwick, you were so thrilled by all that you did and had that you went away dedicated wholly to God. Then were your mouth turned to laughter and your tongues to sing. How is it now? Not this morning, I don't mean. Let's go back to last Thursday when we were in the midst of the troubles of the week. What were we like then? And how was our keenness then? Look again at these people and see what happened to them. First of all, notice that the task they undertook of going down to the land of their fathers and building again the city and the temple was harder than they had expected. The glow of spiritual fervour cooled off when they met the roughness and the coldness of the people who were there. Secondly, some of them were prosperous. They had nice homes. And in the comfort of their homes, the panel dwellings that they had, what did it matter if the Lord's house was waste? As Emerson said, the trouble with money is it costs too much. The third thing is that the Samaritans sneered at them. and religion became not quite the thing. They were troubled by the outsiders. That's it. Briefly and bluntly, those were the three things that were wrong with them. Now, do you think there's any point in this for us? Is it really a historical message, or is there not something behind it? May it not be that we have slacked because the Lord's work was harder than we thought it was going to be? Could it not be that better personal circumstances have caused us to lower the standard of our service? May it not be that we have come to feel a little bit beneath us some of the things that at first we were honored to do and felt it an honor? Well, this is a study. It isn't an exhortation. But the questions are there of necessity and must be answered individually. That the mountain stream should end in mud, methinks, is melancholy. Haggai was a messenger to such a people as had come from being a mountain stream to being ending in mud. So he says to them, there was a time for making a new start. Verse 7, chapter 1. Consider your ways. Go up to the mountain, bring wood, build a house, and I will take pleasure in it, and I will be glorified. Verse 12. Then Zerubbabel the son of Shealtiel and Joshua the son of Josedek the high priest, with all the remnant of the people, obeyed the voice of the Lord their God, and the words of Haggai the prophet, as the Lord their God had sent him. And the people did fear before the Lord. Then spake Haggai in the words Lord's message. And the Lord stirred up the spirit of Zerubbabel, and the spirit of Joshua, and the spirit of all the remnant of the people. Notice that, the reiteration there. The Lord stirred up the spirit of the governor, stirred up the spirit of the high priest, stirred up the spirit of the people. There was that inner desire to serve God, which must be there for an effective service. And if we have lost the glow that makes us become slack, it may be that we have lost touch with God. But Haggai has more than just rebuke for this people. Now they have been awakened in conscience, are desirous and moving towards work, he has for them a word of encouragement. It's necessary because when we come to the second chapter, we notice that they have been disheartened for another reason. In the seventh month, the 21st day of the month, came the word of the Lord by the prophet Haggai, saying, speak now to Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and to Joshua, the son of Josedek, the high priest, and to the residue of the people, saying, who is left among you that saw this house in her first glory? And how do you see it now? Is it not in your eyes in comparison of it as nothing? They were saying, this temple will never be as good as the old one, which of course was perfectly true, because it never could be. The old is never as good as that which has gone. This generation is one of the melancholy mixtures of life, that the old is good, that the new is never as good as the old. And here there was a deep say about they used to be. This is deep. A wondrous glory. Ezra, in his earlier temple, and see how deeply the people were touched
chapter 3 of Ezra. Money had been taken. They sang together by Kos. And all the people shouted with a great shout when they praised the Lord because of the foundation of the house of the Lord was laid. But many of the priests and house was laid before their eyes with a loud voice, so much so that there was a mingling with those who cried for joy, with those who wept when they considered what had gone. And so often in life we need to remember that the joys of the new estate are sorrow to others. So, because of this reflection, God, through his prophet, gives his people a most remarkable reassurance, reminding them, first of all, of his covenanted faithfulness, of his faithfulness which had brought them up out of Egypt and never forsaken them at all. And to that covenant adds promises of spiritual blessing. And notice how again the prophecy is precisely dated on the 21st day of October. Now, it's a significant date this time because they were actually at the end of the Feast of Tabernacles, which, you know, was a real Jewish holiday of rejoicing, and that was just finishing. They ought to have been in the very heights of delight, and yet they were miserable. No doubt because their delight had a rather hollow sound to it. And so, this encouragement, chapter 2, verse 4. Yet now be strong, O Zerubbabel, saith the Lord, and be strong, O Joshua, the son of Josedek, the high priest, and be strong, all ye people of the land, saith the Lord, and work, for I am with you, saith the Lord of hosts. According to the word that I covenanted with you when ye came out of Egypt, so my spirit remaineth among you, fear you not. For thus saith the Lord of hosts, yet once, it is a little while, when I will shake the heavens and the earth and the sea and the dry land, and I will shake all nations, and the desire of all nations shall come, and I will fill this house with glory, saith the Lord of hosts. The silver is mine, and the gold is mine, saith the Lord of hosts. The glory of this latter house shall be greater than the former, saith the Lord of hosts, and in this place will I give peace. The people were taken back, you see, to another beginning, to their coming out of Egypt, to the time when they had been taken as the people of God, to the time when they had stood at Sinai, and the mount had quaked greatly, and there was the smoke and the shaking, and the Lord had descended on it in fire, and the smoke thereof ascended as the smoke of a furnace, and the whole mount quaked greatly. Now they have been reminded of this. And the force of the reminder of the connection is shown us particularly if we look at Hebrews 12, where the writer there has, in a sense, drawn together both these ideas of the quaking at Sinai and this quaking that Haggai is mentioning. Hebrews 12:25-26. Whose voice then shook the earth, but now he hath promised, saying, yet once more I shake not the earth only, but also heaven. And this word yet once more signifieth the removing of those things that are shaken as of things that are made, that those things which cannot be shaken may remain. Wherefore, we receiving a kingdom which cannot be moved, let us have grace, whereby we may serve God acceptably with reverence and godly fear. When God speaks again, and when next he gives the law not to a nation, but to a world, there will be a shaking not only of the ground, but a shaking of peoples, and a shaking of thrones, and a shaking of principles too. Such a shaking as will issue in, as Haggai tells us in towards the end of this chapter of chapter 2, and the latter part of verse 21, I will shake the heavens and the earth, and I will overthrow the throne of kingdoms. I will destroy the strength of the kingdoms of the heathen, and I will overthrow the chariots and those that ride in them, and the horses and their riders shall come down, every one by the sword of his brother. A shaking that will terminate in a kingdom which cannot be shaken, which of course is a truer understanding of that verse towards the end of Hebrews. We have considered, Paul says here, the law that came with a shaking in a mountain. There will be a shaking amongst the nations which will culminate in a kingdom which cannot be shaken. The effect of this will be, Haggai says, that the desire of all nations shall come. And those are words which generally are applied to Jesus. Beautifully, of course, they are applied to Jesus. When we hear them in Messiah, the desire of all nations shall come. But who may abide the day of his coming? Who shall stand when he appeareth? For he is like a refiner's fire. And they sound certainly true of the Lord. And yet, Jesus is the need, most certainly, of all the nations, but not the desire, which is a different thing. And the prophet doesn't mean that. And he's not speaking, I think, here of Jesus. The word desire, as it is used here, means something rather different. It's a plural word, a collective word, which means rather desirable things. And really, that's the understanding of it in the context. If you look for a moment at Daniel chapter 11, the exact word is used there in the 8th verse. And shall also carry captives into Egypt their gods, with their princes, and with their precious vessels of silver and gold. Your margins will probably give you there the vessels of their desire. And the precious there is precisely the same word as we have in Haggai. And later on in this very same chapter, at the 43rd verse, he shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver and over the precious things of Egypt, is a derivative of exactly the same word. Now, that of course makes a bit more sense of the 8th verse of Haggai 2. Because after having said that the desire of all nations, the desirable things of all nations shall come, the silver is mine and the gold is mine, which of course begins to fit now. It has part of the prophecy. All the wealth of the earth is God's, and all the desirable things belong to God.
And although this house that is being built now might seem poor and bare, yet the day will come when all the wealth of the world's stores of treasures and precious things will be brought to the temple of the Lord. The kings of Tarshish and of the Isle shall bring presents. The kings of Sheba and Seba shall offer gifts. Isaiah, in the 60th chapter, that begins, you know, "Arise, shine, for thy light is come," elaborates upon that kind of theme and speaks of the forces of the nations being brought, when forces there is the wealth of the nation. So that eventually the glory of the house that shall be, of course, not the one that they are building now, the latter house, will be greater than anything having been seen before. Now, about a month after that prophecy, Zechariah adds his word to Haggai. And here I speak by permission, having been allowed by Gordon to borrow this little bit. He had so many chapters and couldn't possibly get it in all this time, so as the BBC would say, Zechariah is appearing now by permission of Gordon Hammond. Zechariah speaks immediately after this message of Haggai's. The first six verses of Zechariah come exactly after that, with only this difference that there isn't the precision of dating. We have now the eighth month in the second year of Darius. We know the month on our calendar, November, but not which day of the month. Never mind, we have the message nonetheless. The Lord hath been sore displeased with your fathers. Therefore say thou unto them, thus saith the Lord of hosts, turn ye unto me, saith the Lord of hosts, and I will turn unto you, saith the Lord of hosts. Be not as your fathers, unto whom the former prophets have cried, saying, thus saith the Lord of hosts, turn ye now from your evil ways, from your evil doings. They did not hear, nor hearken unto me, saith the Lord. Your fathers, where are they? And the prophets, do they live forever? And so on. I want you to notice how timely is this message of Zechariah's here. How Zechariah desired to direct the people both to God and to Haggai. How he seeks to implement Haggai's already delivered message. The people were disheartened when they looked back. All they could see in the past, as we would of course, all they could see was the good things they'd lost. Now Zechariah says there's another aspect of this. Whilst you're looking back upon all the glories you have lost, just for a moment, Zechariah says, meditate upon how you came to lose them. And so, with that deliberate thrust, he turns their reminiscences upon them. Their disobedience, the disobedience of their fathers, of course, and their willful neglect of God was the trouble. So he says, don't repeat the follies of your fathers. And if you want to see a glorious temple, if that's what you're concerned about, remember that the first thing about temples and temple worship is obedience to God, which always has been more important than sacrifice. And, as I said, he turns their very reminiscences upon them. Whilst Haggai exhorts them by a forward look, Zechariah is also telling them to have a look back as well about their past disobedience. But Zechariah, however, was not a backward-looking prophet, as we shall see very soon. Because only 2 months or so after the conclusion of Haggai's last words,
Zechariah suddenly comes out in that blaze of revelation, which gives us all the ideas about the coming of Messiah and kindred topics. Now, the remainder of the prophecy is centered on the third and fourth messages, which both came upon the same day. Whilst we were thinking a little while ago about after a whole lifetime, or during a whole lifetime, only 4 months are given to this man in prophecy, here, out of that 4 months, two of the messages come on one day. So it is. The messages are similar in import to the first and second prophecies, except for a rather interesting twist in each case, in each prophecy. The third message is preceded by a parable. Begins in the 10th verse, but we'll take a parable at the 11th. Ask now the priests concerning the law. The priests were to be put in their accepted position of teachers of the people. Go to these people who teach you and ask them. If one bear holy flesh in the skirt of his garment, and with his skirt do touch bread or pottage or wine or oil or meat, shall it be holy? No. Oh no. No matter how clean the priest is, if something unclean be touched, then the priest is unclean until he has been cleansed. All right. If one that is unclean by a dead body touch any of these, shall it be unclean? It shall be unclean. There's a parable here, a parable which is stating a principle that these people had neglected. And the principle was that evil is far more catching than good, and that evil spread more quickly than good, and that in effect, whilst they were making shift, as they were in effect, with their solitary altar, and were not building the temple, whilst they were trying to offer sacrifices under those conditions, their sacrifices were always touched, contaminated by the spirit of worldliness which was causing them to neglect building their temple. And until they got away from that spirit of worldliness, none of their sacrifices would be of any avail. There was a taint and a guilt about it until they built the house of God. And moreover, all their bad seasons would continue until they had removed that taint. But from the time that they did turn around to God, then there was this: from this day I will bless you. So in the fourth message, here again is an extra little word. It's a personal note, the fourth message, to Zerubbabel. Speak to Zerubbabel, the governor. In that day, the 23rd verse, in that day, saith the Lord of hosts, will I take thee, O Zerubbabel, my servant, saith the Lord, and I will make thee as a signet, for I have chosen thee, saith the Lord of hosts, in that day when the kingdoms of men have been superseded by the kingdom which cannot be shaken. There will be a dramatic reversal of Judah's fortunes. I will make thee as a signet, which is of course a mark of honour and of distinction. You know how the people looked up immediately to Joseph when Pharaoh took him and gave him his own ring, made him the first in the land. You know how Haman strutted proudly for a while when he wore the king's ring. Or how lifted up was the poor prodigal when he returned and received the ring from his father. Well, even more dramatic is this for another reason. The reason being that to this same Zerubbabel there was an added point about the note to him, because it was his own grandfather, yes, who had heard this from God in Jeremiah 22 verse 24. Though Jeconiah were the signet on my right hand, yet would I pluck thee hence. And here's this
dramatic saying that as the signet had been plucked off in God's anger because of the disobedience of his people, the day was coming when Israel again would be restored to a position of honour at God's hand. And this promise, which of course is in a sense a reiteration made of the promise made to David, the father of this line, for of course Zerubbabel was of the line of David, is repeated to him here, and by the nature of it, he becomes a type of Messiah, of Christ. Because the glory of the house and of the kingdom that is spoken of here, when he will be made as a signet, is a glory for a king of a later date, of a king long after Zerubbabel had slept with his fathers, when the greater power of great David's greater son had come again.